Welcome to the Special Sauce Podcast, real conversations about food and life, hosted by Serious Eats founder, Ed Levine.
Uniformity and cleanliness still kind of dominate the way that we look at food. And even as we want things that are personal to us, we still want things that are familiar.
I think that the duality of the fast food industry is just the crisis of capitalism brought to you with a milkshake.
On this episode of Special Sauce, franchise author Marsha Chatelain, Drive-Thru Dreams writer Adam Chandler, and Kenji all weigh in on the evils and the pleasure many of us derive from fast food.
It's all coming up on Special Sauce.
We are back with franchise author Marsha Chatelain and Drive-Thru Dreams author Adam Chandler talking about, what else, fast food. So I want to talk about how fast food has attempted to adapt in these ever-changing times. How has it evolved in your view, Adam?
Fast food is constantly in this shifting landscape. It's constantly firing at a moving target. And that's one of the things that keeps it relevant to the extent that it can be relevant. I describe fast food often as having 20-30 vision. It's never quite on the cutting edge, but that's sort of one of the major features of it, is that when something sort of hits the mainstream, you become aware of it because fast food restaurants have brought it into their arsenal, whether it's an ingredient. You know, sriracha is one example of something that was cool in culinary circles in 2012 and 2013, obviously way before that in other places, but arrived on menus in 2015 at McDonald's and Burger King and elsewhere. And that suddenly reflected what a lot of people's way into one trend was.
Yeah. What about you, Marsha? How do you think fast food has attempted to adapt? And do you see any changes for the better, for the worse, or are we just treading water?
I think that fast food has tried to keep up with what fast casual has provided. So fast casual is this category that obscures its dependence and its roots in fast food. It's kind of like the snooty cousin who comes to the holiday gathering, but you remember, you know, before the snooty cousin had, you know, a fancy car and a fancy job. And so its origins are fast food, but the way that it distances itself from fast food is interesting, because then fast food is trying to replicate it all at the same time. And I think you see that in the focus on ingredients. After the pink slime controversy that McDonald's had to engage in about the binding that's put in hamburger patties and other types of meats, then this kind of focus on sourcing and ingredients is the democratization of farm to table, essentially. I would never imagine 20 years ago McDonald's telling me what farm the eggs came from for an Egg McMuffin.
I know, that is so weird. I don't even know what to say.
You know, is it two for one or what? But it's trying to take its cues from a sector of the industry that it gave birth to. I guess it's like deeply Freudian, in which the betrayal is happening from its own child. But I think that what we're seeing is this idea that fast food can be clean food too, and everyone ignoring that all of these foods that are delivered to us fast are just all sodium and calories.
Yeah, it's interesting because in a way, McDonald's is becoming Sweetgreen, which is the quintessential fast casual restaurant, right?
I feel indicted. I love Sweetgreen. I'm part of the problem.
But Sweetgreen is also becoming McDonald's now. That's sort of one thing that has also been curious about the last couple of months in particular. Sweetgreen and Chipotle and all of these fast casual brands that pride themselves on transparency are now opening drive-through lanes and drive-through windows, and they're delivering their food through ghost kitchens. And that used to be their ultimate line against fast food, was that you can see your food being assembled and cooked in front of you in a kitchen, and you have access to the visuals of it. You can see it, as opposed to the heat lamps and whatever weird stuff goes on in the back that they raise the sinister, rightly raise the sinister sort of specter of in fast food. And so the pandemic and probably just the scaling that they're undergoing has driven them to take on these fast food measures. Which is funny to see, because these are chains that swore up and down that they would never be these fast food brands, and yet they're adopting some of these methods.
Marsha, I'm sure you know this, that Sweetgreen was started by three Georgetown grads.
Oh, I know. Can I tell you, it's all over campus, and they have been very generous with our students by donating, and the original Sweetgreen location is right off of M Street, and, you know, it's such an expensive salad, and I think it is part of my own discomfort with my own class ascension that I spend so much on lunch, and I think, to Adam's point, though, you know, what's interesting about a lot of the Sweetgreen locations here in D.C. is a lot of them are staffed by people of color, not unlike fast food, that it is a space in which there is some type of sense that culinary skill is appreciated. But the work is grueling. The work is labor intensive. Sometimes the diners are rude. And it's this really just interesting way of trying to make prestige fast food a thing. And I think Starbucks probably, you know, their entry into the coffee market created that. And it's just so interesting to see that regardless of the aesthetic delivery of these food concepts, the supply chain and the labor issues that are associated with, you know, workers remains the same.
Yeah, that's interesting. I believe that Sweetgreen does pay minimum wage, although I'm not 100% sure about that.
You mean like a living wage?
Would we consider $15 an hour a living wage?
Well, I think some of their localities demand it, right? Like, so in D.C., it's required, New York City. So I think that's the other thing in terms of where fast food is going. I think that some of the concern about the minimum wage is going to be misrepresented by a lot of brands that concentrate in cities that compel it, but can also be a talking point. Like, we pay a $15 an hour wage, and it's like asterisk because we are forced to by the local government.
Yeah, and this whole issue of McDonald's, the tagline, America's best first job, that's not the whole story. And I'm not even sure it's true. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's not true. But first jobs in general for people of color and for immigrants, they tend to be like in poultry processing plants or fast food, or I did some consulting in airline catering, and that's exactly who staffs airline catering kitchens. I was working for Northwest Airlines, so I would go to Minneapolis for meetings all the time, and I would meet in the catering kitchens there, and it was truly a diverse population. You know, there were Hmongs and there were Cambodians and there were, you know, East Africans. It was fascinating. And I guess really the question is, can fast food or fast casual, can they afford to pay a living wage, whatever that living wage is? And the answer is probably yes. But it's a pretty complicated question in that I was once at a symposium and someone asked this barbecue guy, why don't you use sustainably raised pigs? He said, because then I'd have to charge 50 cents more a sandwich and my customers would go somewhere else. And it's not that I necessarily believed him, but it does raise an interesting point about the whole thing.
One thing we're seeing a lot of is when that talking point is deployed about not being able to pay your employees well enough without raising the prices on customers, there's so many different ways you go with that. There's the cost of a Big Mac in Australia or Finland where they pay their workers really well, and it's not that much higher. And then you have on the industry side, they talk about automation. There's basically, we're going to automate away these jobs if the labor costs get too high. And you see these kiosks where you place your orders now, and the mobile ordering is a big push to move the labor away from the franchisees in terms of the cost and toward profits. And so it's not a sustainable system. And I think it's going to continue to sort of be that way until potentially most of these jobs are automated out. And I think that's the way the industry is going to go rather than end up paying more. They talk about slashing hours. Instead of having a 24-hour McDonald's, they have one that's open from, you know, 6 a.m. to midnight or something like that, just because it doesn't behoove them to pay more.
But doesn't this really just go back to Marcia's fundamental point, which is, sure, if the government stepped up and paid for childcare, and if the government stepped up and did all these things that they don't do, we'd be having a very different discussion, right, Marcia?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is the question that needs to be placed in front of everyone. Is our goal to live in a society where there are no poor people? Is our goal to live in a society where if you are poor, it doesn't mean you have a life without dignity? Is the goal to create a system in which you and your employer are locked into this deeply dependent relationship that without your employer, you can't go to a hospital? Without your employer, you can't afford to be sick. Without your employer, there's nowhere to put your kids during the day, right? So I guess the fundamental question about all of these issues, after you pay 50 cents more for your sandwich, the unfortunate reality is that some people are paying hundreds of thousands of dollars less as taxpayers. And so it's this weird kind of calculation that we make that we don't want consumer goods to be too expensive. And we also don't want to pay into a public good. And so it's like, what are our options here? I think about this a lot with seafood. Every time I like make something at home, I think the person who brought the seafood to me should make $40 million a year. I like go fishing sometimes. I've been crabbing before. The human toll of doing any of these things is exhaustive. It's existentially challenging. And you think, should I be able to buy a package of fish fillets for $15? This is not nearly enough money for the food that I'm getting and the process it takes for me to get it. And I think that this is what really good conversations about food justice and inequality have to force us to think. Well, then what is it worth for a person to take so many risks in order for me to eat?
There was a woman in Madison, Wisconsin, Odessa Piper, who was called the Midwestern Alice Waters. And I once heard her give a talk to some students in Madison when I was writing a book chapter on her. And she said, people who can afford it just have to pay more for food. And that's a radical concept, right? You know, we all delight in bargains, but they're Faustian bargains.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting on this note is, and again, not, I feel bad for bagging on Georgetown alum Sweetgreen founders, but there was recently this policy decision they made, I think it was 2017, where store-wide they would stop accepting cash. And with the exception of, I think, stores in Massachusetts where it's outlawed, you have to take cash. But that sends a clear signal for the unbanked who a $12 or $15 salad is for, when you can't use anything but a credit card or a debit card inside of a store. So even when it's more expensive, it also is prohibitive in other ways. And that's another component of this that gets mixed up is when you eat at nicer places, you draw a less economically diverse crowd as a result. And it's self-selecting and it kind of saps the humanity out of a place in a lot of ways because it's, you can just tell it's segmented. And it's not really what dining out should be about, in my opinion, at least. This is a conversation that happens all across food. And this is something that I was a bartender for about 6 years in New York. And my experience with that was sort of doing really well in terms of a happy hour shift with tips and then tipping out my staff who was making minimum wage in the kitchen. And they were working twice as hard as I was under more intense circumstances. None of us had health insurance. And this was a, you know, in some instances, a nicer restaurant. So this isn't just a fast food conversation and it's not just a fast casual conversation. It's definitely a conversation that spans the entire industry when it comes to food justice and sort of how to create environments that are sustainable for diners and for employees. And we're really seeing the effects of that now with restaurant workers during the pandemic.
Food justice is a macro issue that crosses class lines. It's across the country and really across the world, right? And yet it's a term that we're only now hearing, right, Marcia? Food justice is a relatively recent notion.
Right. I think so much of the conceptualization has been, do people have food to eat or do they not? Right. And I think that comes out of the kind of benevolence, charity idea of, you know, some have and some don't. And so what do you do about it? But I think increasingly, as we become more aware of the environmental impacts of different types of agriculture, we're starting to learn more, I think, on a popular basis of like what it takes, you know, for Costco to have a $5 chicken, which I'm obsessed with. All of these things, they come at a social cost. And I think that if COVID provides us anything, are more entryways into having that conversation about, you know, I mean, it's devastating to see the losses of restaurants. It's devastating to see the number of restaurant and grocery workers who just get COVID so they can work. And all of these debates about indoor dining, I think that we are starting to realize that food is actually an issue of citizen concern. It isn't just a product that we consume and we're upset if the prices aren't right. It's actually requires us to be active participants in thinking about policy around food. And I think that the more we do that, the better we are.
And the pandemic has really just forced us to focus on that, right? When we have managers of poultry processing plants placing wagers on which workers are going to get sick or die, then you know we have a problem. I've known for years and I've written about the true cost of chicken, as you say, is so much more than the $2 a pound, right? I mean, you mentioned Costco chicken, which you love, right? And Costco just announced that they're going to raise their minimum wage to $17.50, right? Or whatever it is. So on the face of it, you go, hey, that's awesome. That was my first reaction. But then if you go deeper and you go beneath the surface, the whole point of Costco sort of encourages food injustice at many points along the way.
I think part of this has to do with the reality that we think of these things as being apolitical. And this is something anytime you see a food magazine or, you know, a sports blog take a strong stance on something that's happening in the world, people will say, you know, I'm here for the recipes or stick to sports. And the way that these all intersect, it has never been more important and has never been more apparent. And I think, you know, slowly but surely, folks are starting to see that's true. And they're hopefully stopping the urge to segment them or separate them into being separate entities. They all intersect, and it's important to acknowledge that, and it's important to see that.
I think this is such a difficult one because, you know, these conversations about wages open up a conversation of how much people should make and how much money does one need. And I think, again, if we embed certain things that we need within being people in a society, so it's, you know, healthcare, education, you know, access to a good museum now and then, like if we clear that off of everyone's personal balance sheet, then maybe we can have clarity about what a good wage is. But we have no idea. You know, I was just doing the math and, you know, a $17 an hour wage, you know, that's like $32,000 a year. My question is, what's your second job? There's a Costco not too far from my house. You can't live on that in Washington, D.C., in the suburban area. So that's your first job. How much are you working your second job? Or how many people do you have in your household who are also making $17 an hour to make it? And so I think that, what does this mean for all of us? I think that we have to understand that there's a cost at some point in the equation. The question is, where do we pay it?
Right. And fast food has been first and foremost about value. And all Sweetgreen and Shake Shack have done really is just to move the bar up, right? When we were growing up, the idea was you could get a fast food meal for $5 or $7. And now what you're saying is you feel guilty that you want a Sweetgreen salad for lunch, and then if you get one of their lime cucumber drinks, you're not getting any change back from $20.
I'm in for a full $20. And it's based on this kind of idea of higher food quality.
And yet, I have to say, this is the great quandary I'm in about fast food. I love the McDonald's quarter pounder that's made to order. It makes me feel guilty.
Yeah.
But it really is better than the ones that were made. And I go out of my way for a Popeye's fried chicken sandwich, even though I know all these things that we're saying are true. In a way, it's the ultimate almost guilty pleasure. It's just weird when you think about it. But you're right. I've been thinking about Costco a lot just because they announced they were raising the minimum wage. And as Marcia points out, okay, let's do the math here. Who's living on that? And if they are, how are they living? They're living with, how do I pay the bills to keep the lights on and the gas on? And they're not putting money away. That's for sure.
We'll be back later on Special Sauce with more of my far-reaching conversation with Marcia Chatelain and Adam Chandler. But first, I wanted to ask Kenji if he ever thought about the politics of fast food.
I have to say, I haven't done as much research as I, you know, not enough research to speak in a very knowledgeable way about this. When I did really start thinking about it a lot more was actually during the pandemic, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, when one of my cooks, my sous chef, Orlando, his wife worked at a fast food restaurant. And at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, we had lots of discussions at our restaurant with management and with all the staff and with everyone talking about what we wanted to do as a team in order to keep everyone safe, what people's needs were as far as a paycheck and food and supplies and things, because the restaurant was essentially shut down. And even after the city gave the go-ahead to reopen, it was a big discussion about how do we keep people safe while working and what, you know, how many people can we have working at a time? Who gets to work, you know, because we can't bring back all the people who were working at the same time, and what happens to the people who aren't getting shifts, and all these questions. And meanwhile, you drive by the drive-through place down the street and it's packed with cooks inside, right? And restaurants were deemed sort of essential workplaces. And so Orlando was saying that, you know, his wife was working in these crowded kitchens. It was just as crowded as it was before. And that there were several scares. Luckily, she never got sick, but, you know, other people who she worked with got sick, and it spread to other people within the kitchen. And it was like, it really, really drove home to me just like this idea that we're deeming these people essential and we're asking them to risk our lives so that we can have cheap hamburgers. And at the same time, you know, we're paying them maybe a little above minimum wage, maybe.
Maybe.
And so, you know, obviously there seems to be a big problem with that. And I don't know what the solution is, right? Because it's not easy to just say, well, pay them more, you know. And certainly, you know, some fast food companies make huge profits. And so, yes, you can probably afford to pay your workers more. But at the other hand, it's like mom and pop restaurants, like they don't make profits. The owners very rarely make any money, and people are not willing to pay more for their food. People still want those cheap hamburgers.
Right.
But it is nice when you hear about restaurants that treat their employees well. So, you know, places where people seem genuinely happy to work, you know, places like, for instance, like In-N-Out is known for treating its employees well. I recently moved to Seattle, and there's this small chain here called Dick's. I don't know if you've been there.
I have.
The employees start out at $17 an hour, which is well above minimum wage. So it seems like it can be done. But as with most things, you know, capitalism and corporate profits too often trump human dignity and human decency.
For sure. I think you said something that's really, really important, which people don't really want to accept. Even if their politics are progressive, they're not willing to pay more for food.
Right. That's a problem we ran into with the menu at Worst Hall, right? It's like people want the higher quality meat. People want to see employees paid better, paid a living wage, you know, but a living wage in the Bay Area is like $40 an hour, something like that. And we were paying our cooks well above what other restaurants in the neighborhood are, but it's still not $40 an hour. So it's like, what do you do? It's like, do you charge $36 for a hamburger just to be able to balance your budget? And the answer is no, because then nobody buys a hamburger. There's no simple solution for individual owners. You know, I think there has to be a much bigger sort of statewide and nationwide, you know, political movement to fix some of these problems. The pandemic has at least shined a light on some of this stuff, which has gotten some of these movements going.
Which is great. I think you've given us much wisdom in a relatively short period of time here.
Thank you. We're back with franchise author Marcia Chatelain and drive-through dreams writer Adam Chandler, and I asked them to weigh in on the dual nature of good and evil when it comes to fast food.
This conversation has made me think about when we're talking about food quality versus worker experience. This goes back 100 years to the founding of White Castle, which, you know, I would say is the first fast food chain. And one of the animating factors of this chain becoming popular was that they standardized everything. They made every store look the same. They really emphasized cleanliness. And part of that was because of The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, which was, you know, a book that really messed with Americans' minds about what was happening with their food. Now, the funny part about that, obviously, tragically funny, is that Upton Sinclair wrote the book to make people aware of how the workers were being treated in meat factories, but people read the horror stories of people in factories with meat that was rotting and spoiling in the sun and serving it and shipping it out. And they said, I'm not going to eat beef anymore, or I'm going to change my eating habits. They didn't really care about the workers. And so that really drove the early days of fast food to emphasize uniformity and the comfort of that and cleanliness. And that's a big part of why a lot of these stores look the same, is the consistency factor and the familiarity factor, even if that extends today. If you are going to an airport and you have a choice between Greg's Barbecue or Popeyes, and you don't necessarily know that much about Greg's Barbecue, even though I'd probably take a chance on it, you know you're going to get the fried chicken sandwich at Popeyes because chances are you know exactly what you're going to get. And so that expectation still kind of dominates the way that we look at food. And even as we want things that are personal to us, we still want things that are familiar.
I think that the duality of the fast food industry is just, you know, the crisis of capitalism brought to you with a milkshake. I think that's everything, right? It's the clothes that we wear. It's the neighborhoods we move into, the cars that we drive. And while it may feel like it's impossible and out of our hands in terms of making always the right decisions, I think that we all have the capacity to say, okay, here are the consumer choices I'm making, and making a conscientious consumer choice is not the kind of beginning and end of my political engagement, because that isn't how it works. We don't buy our ways towards a greater sense of community. We work in various ways. But the one thing I will say about the fast food industry that I did not appreciate until I spent so much time researching is that it is strangely creative and mundane all at the same time. The food is uninspired, but the world that has to be created around the food to make it feel special and interesting is amazing to me. The cartoon characters, the toys, I've been doing a newsletter on fast food history, and just like all of the different animated objects that become part of a new product line, I really appreciate the artistry that is part of the fast food machinery. Even though, again, it's not the finest art, but boy, do you have to come up with a lot of ideas in order to have a fast food company sustain its brand identity for decades.
That's so interesting, because really what you're saying is fast food has this insane ability to attach itself to pop culture.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's country singers or rappers, and there's a history to this, right? I mean, Dr. John wrote the famous Popeyes jingle, right? And I'm sure, Adam, you have many examples of pop stars over the years and country stars and all kinds of musicians. Mahalia Jackson had a fried chicken franchise, right?
She absolutely did.
And Adam, you write a lot about the way Taco Bell has mastered social media. It's all part of the same thing that Marcia's bringing up, which is, you know, their messaging can sometimes be ham-handed, but is often brilliant. And their packaging is just astounding.
Right. They're allowed to not be self-serious in a way that the social media for Mercedes-Benz has to be self-serious, you know? They get to show a messy table with ketchup smeared all over a tray, and it looks relatable and fun, and they get to just be a little wacky and a little goofy, and that's part of the experience. I mean, there is a democratic aspect to fast food that I think makes it so appealing in a lot of ways. The fact that you are not going to get a good table at a McDonald's. They're all bad tables. Or they're all good tables, you know, maybe this is a glass half empty, glass half full thing, but you're going to eat with your hands and you're not going to have a plate. And that is kind of what it gets to. It is very primal in a fun way that I think reflects itself in the advertising, which is, it's like a kid's menu no matter what you're getting. And that's part of the allure. I think that's a big part of knowing that you get to just not think about it. And that kind of goes to what we're talking about, I think, in terms of elevating fast food or changing fast food, is even as we look at things like Beyond Meat and the Impossible Burger or more vegetarian options and better choices for people who are having more specific dietary needs, the history of fast food in terms of it being healthier has just been met with this collective yawn by people who don't go to McDonald's or go to Burger King to eat a salad. And that's really what I think we see some of the marketing being so macho and meat heavy all these years is kind of speaks to that. They know who their core base is. A lot of these companies may have flirted with having food that was a little bit healthier, a little bit better, and they were just met with derision by their core base or apathy. And that's really not what they want. And so you see things go in more ridiculous terms instead of less ridiculous terms as a result.
It's so interesting because, to Marcia's point, it's almost like they understand that the packaging and the messaging is way more important than the food. The food is the last thing on the line.
Yes, absolutely. No offense, Adam, but Taco Bell really, I feel like, signifies that. Each item more dreadful than the last.
Yeah, that's what they do so well.
It's about a set of experiences. And I also think it's about repetition, right? You will have memories of something that is omnipresent. I think I went to Thomas Keller's Ad Hoc one time, and I guess it was a fabulous meal. But I can kind of tell you what I ate that night, but I can tell you everything right on the Wendy's menu, including the years that it had a salad bar and the baked potato. So I think that, you know, there's something about that space between repetition and packaging that makes it work.
We could talk about fast food all day. I love hanging out with the two of you and talking about fast food. But now I'm going to ask Marcia a couple of questions that Adam's already answered on an older episode of Special Sauce. So, who's at your last supper? No family allowed. And, you know, you can have a minimum of four guests. You could have five. They could be living or dead. Could be artists, painters, politicians, poets. You get it.
Okay. I would have dinner with the late John Lewis, who was such a special human being, and I had gotten to interact with a few times when he was alive. I would love to share a dinner table with the great activist Ida B. Wells Barnett, because she is one of these fascinating women from history who marked her displeasure with everyone as it was unfolding. And she has her diary, her autobiography is just every kind of bone that she has to pick. She did it in the moment. So I would love to just see her give people real-time feedback on what they weren't or were doing.
She's an early civil rights activist, right?
The early civil rights anti-lynching activist, suffragist, and just a person who was so unafraid to give people the feedback that they deserved. I would have Georgie Gilmore there. Georgie Gilmore was one of the black women who participated in the Montgomery bus boycott. And she said that she was part of the Nobody Club, that she wasn't part of the elite of the town, but she was a talented cook and she made, like, you know, fried chicken sandwiches and cakes to support the movement. So I would love for her an opportunity to sit down and have a nice meal. And then I think I would, I'd probably have, let me try to think, a writer that I adore. I would invite Maya Angelou, because in addition to being an incredible writer, she loved food. And so I love dining with people who also love food, because they see the experience as not just one of consumption, but analysis as well. And so I would love to hear what she thought of the menu. And I would not do the cooking, because I'd be too emotionally sensitive to have this group in front of me.
I just had Jessica Harris on Special Sauce, and her memoir, there's a lot about Maya in it. And I also had Alexander Smalls on Special Sauce, who cooked a lot for Maya and Cicely Tyson. And so I'd like to have dinner with Maya Angelou, too. Could me and Adam come?
you guys would be more than welcome, because she loved food. And I think that's the thing. Have you ever had dinner with someone who like says they're not that into food? And it's just so confusing as to what is there else to be into.
So wait, you said you wouldn't be doing the cooking. So my next question is, what would you be eating?
I think breakfast is a special meal, and I don't understand people, like, for their anniversary, they go to a steakhouse, which is like, ugh, who wants a giant steak? Because breakfast allows you to eat unlimited sweet and savory, and as someone who really likes dessert, I feel a traditional dinner really confines you, unless you're doing some wild tasting menu. But I don't like a tasting menu because I don't like staying up all day and eating. I like all of it in front of me, eggs benedict, waffles, pancakes, French toast. I love breakfast. It's so special.
I love this. I love this. Lastly, it's just been declared Marcia Chatelain Day all over the world. What's happening on that day?
Oh my gosh. On Marcia Chatelain Day, you get to tax the rich at whatever level you want. You enjoy unlimited portions of Eggs Benedict and blinis, and you drink mimosas all day, and you listen to, you know, feminist folk music from the 90s. I mean, what a horrific and fabulous day that would be.
All right, so this is a question for both of you. This is a new one. I'm granting you one superpower each. Okay, I'll give Marcia a little bit of a rest since she answered a bunch of other questions. So, Adam, I grant you one superpower.
I really wish I could be magnanimous and do something really fantastic and virtuous for the world, but I just think a teenage metabolism would really be the thing. I think that's the superpower I want at this point in my life, is just complete control over that. It would probably be more superpowers, the gift of giving myself more superpowers, eternal superpowers.
Wow, this is very meta. This is very meta.
I got to order everything. I stop at, you know, McDonald's for the fries, and then I go for a Whopper or Burger King. This is the same thing. This is the same principle.
All right, Marcia.
This one's an easy one for me. Teleportation that comes with unlimited upgrades in hotels. It's 1 year of the pandemic of being at home, and I haven't been on an airplane in about 1 year. And I used to be on an airplane 20 to 40 times a year. And so when you talk about airplane meals, this is also another fascination of mine. And so I love going places. I hate getting there. The airports, the shuttle buses, the awkward, you know, taxi rides, the people movers, all of that stuff. So I wish I could teleport, but then have enough airline and hotel status miles to always get an upgrade when I get to the place that I'm teleporting to.
I love that. I love that.
That's it for this episode of Special Sauce. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another brand new episode. In the meantime, please stay safe and healthy, serious eaters. Wear a highly protective mask, wash your hands often, and practice social distancing. And again, I urge you to do everything you can to support your local restaurants and the purveyors that supply them. The pandemic has wreaked havoc on the restaurants we all know and love. And if you can afford it, order directly from those very same restaurants rather than the corporate delivery apps. Or donate to worthy organizations like No Kid Hungry or Feeding America, both of which combat the food insecurity an estimated 54 million Americans are grappling with during the pandemic. If you've enjoyed listening to Kenji, Marcia Chatelain, and Adam Chandler, and want more Special Sauce in your life, just subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Here's the best part. It's free. To help spread the word, you can even review Special Sauce on either Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. So long, Serious Eaters. See you next time.
Special Sauce is produced by John Kalish and Ed Levine. Associate producer, Morgan Flannery. Our theme music was composed by Charlie Morrow for Morrow Sound.